Welcome to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast.
Welcome back to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Don leading off the podcast today. Very, very happy to be joined by our regular contributor, show agitator, and just all around good guy, Chris Coppola. Say hi to the good folks.
Hi to the good folks.
There you go. I guess more appropriately today, if you were delivering a greeting that would have been appropriate for the topic of our episode, you wouldn't have said hello. You probably would have given a good solid hola to the good folks that are out there, which is Spanish for hello. And our topic today is actually going to be, we're releasing this a couple of days after the actual event, but we tried to match it up as well as we could without actually changing the release date. We're trying to get back on our Good Friday schedule. So it's the early part of May. And if you are anywhere, particularly in where I'm in Texas, but it's not just limited here to Texas, what do people hear a little about? We're recording before this date, but the release will be after this date. So what did somebody probably celebrate this week, Chris?
Well, it's Mexican Independence Day, only not.
Only it's not. So it's Cinco de Mayo, which probably you just hit upon one of the probably number one misconceptions about that particular date is that it commemorates. And by the way, there's multiple independence elements you might point to in Mexico. It's none of the things you could point to as being Mexican independence or Mexican Revolution or anything else. This is just a different date. We'll talk about why it's important. So it's not Mexican Independence Day, but yet it gets celebrated. It gets celebrated wildly. Well, in the United States, right?
I off podcast, we were talking about this, and I have some co-workers who are out of Massachusetts, and it very much reminded me of their Patriots Day. It is a day that is celebrated in the state of Massachusetts. It commemorates Lexington and Concord. Just happened a couple of weeks ago. And every single year, come April, they find a reason to call me in the week before and talk about how we have next Monday off. You don't, do you? Just to rub that in. And I have to imagine that somewhere down in Mexico, there is somebody doing that from the state of Puebla, because it commemorates the Battle of Puebla. It is celebrated heavily in that state. It's just not celebrated anywhere else. Now, I haven't been able to figure out whether they just completely drop their R's like my Massachusetts friends will, or roll them in Spanish. I'm interested in finding that out.
So now we have a mission in life. So as you might have guessed, because we have intelligent listeners, we're going to be talking about Cinco de Mayo, which commemorates the Battle of Puebla, which was a Mexican victory. We'll talk a little bit about, when we get into the historical, what did, about even over whom, because I'm guessing, I'll just say this, even for those of us that are here in Texas, and it becomes a great day to have, it becomes a great excuse nationwide, but particularly here in the state of Texas, to have some Mexican food, which by that we mean Tex-Mex here in Texas, and to have a margarita, which is, you know, the drink of choice when you're having Tex-Mex here. All of those, you're going to see margarita specials out the wazoo on Cinco de Mayo, because that's what happens, and other things that are there. But all of that's being commemorated and being celebrated again, but nobody, as we point out, really knows what they're commemorating or celebrating in the process. And I'm guessing, again, where I sort of launched off on this before it took a minute for me to get back around to it, is the fact that if I asked, they know it was a Mexican victory, obviously, or else it wouldn't be celebrated, right? But if I asked them, who were they victorious over? I'm guessing half the people probably would not even be able to name the party that they were actually, you say higher, Chris is pointing up. I can see him on video. You're probably right. I'm being generous, but I doubt very much that very many people say, well, of course that was the French, because again, they're thinking, what are the French even doing in Mexico? Right.
I have a standing joke. Cinco de Mayo celebrates the victory over the French army, or as it's called in Germany, Tuesday.
Right. and to understand the time frame that we're talking about here, we're talking about obviously the 5th of May and the year is 1862. And we're going to spend a lot of time talking about why that year is relevant. So this is something that happened. Wow, we're coming up on the 160th anniversary of that event. That puts it in perspective. It's been over 150 years. But it's, again, a lot of people, there's a lot of misconceptions. It's not Mexican Independence Day. It's not any celebration of a Mexican Revolution of another type, because there were always plenty to choose from down in Mexico. Every time you turn around, it commemorates a battle. It does commemorate a Mexican victory. It commemorates that victory over the French. So when we come back from the break here, we're going to launch into, again, we're a what if podcast, but we always have to cover the what did a little bit, maybe even more so in this sense. And then we're going to get off into what I think is a very interesting what if. Well, that would be the fork will be, what if the Mexicans had not won at the Battle of Puebla? And now I'm specifically talking about the one in 1862. We'll even talk about that when we get back into this, because that's important. Timing matters here. So that we hope that you stick with us as we drag out the introduction here longer than we normally do. When we come back, I promise it's going to be something interesting. So stick with us.
Hi, this is Don.
And Alexis.
What are we coming to our potential new listeners about today, Lex?
That'd be our new podcast venture. Wait for it.
Wait for it. Ooh, she stuck in the lyric. Also from what is probably the best musical of the last decade, Lex?
I would second that opinion. It is definitely Hamilton.
Hamilton. Lin-Manuel Miranda's brilliant, groundbreaking, progressive, unique musical that has a historical bend, Hamilton, that swept through Broadway and swept through popular culture in so many ways. And so one of the most interesting things about that, with Alexis and I both being fans of history, is that as we look to start another podcast here and looking to start that with a new group of folks who are going to go on that adventure with us, is we wanted to do something that's a little bit different than our alternate history genre. And so one of the most intriguing songs from Hamilton is what, Lex?
That would be The Room Where It Happened.
The Room Where It Happened, which sort of gives the background story of an event in American history where a deal was cut in a room.
Yes.
And so that started getting me thinking about, what if we did a history podcast where the twist that got us into each episode, which would be a deep exploration of some topic, probably the more obscure but yet the as important, the better, would be things that happened in very different and unique rooms. In other words, what are some other rooms where it happened? So that's what we're launching off here. This is sort of the introduction to that, and we invite you to come back as we begin to publish episodes here over the next couple of months. The name of the podcast is going to be what, Alexis?
The Room Where It Happened.
And what we're going to do is we're going to use that as a launching point to talk about some other interesting rooms where some other interesting things happened. So if you're a fan of history and you like to talk about some of the more interesting sort of sideline parts of history, we think this podcast will be for you, and we invite you to join us once we get rolling.
Hola. Welcome back to A Fork in Time. As we talked about before the break, we're going to be covering today the historical what if around Cinco de Mayo, which commemorates the Mexican victory over the French at the Battle of Puebla. And now, I should have done this while we were in the break, because now I have to do it because of your joke, Chris. I need to find out what day of the week the event actually happened on, to see if it actually was a Tuesday. That's what I now have to find out.
While you're doing that, I'm going to mention this, because in the lead up to this, I realized something. It wasn't funny when it happened.
Correct.
The Germans beating the French wasn't a thing when this happened. Well, it becomes a thing very close to the end of this.
But... yeah. And I think that's an interesting point, because I know for me, and you know, not to speak ill of our, especially if you're an American, those who have often been our allies and have, you know, and have suffered invasion and other issues there as well. But very rarely since the days of Napoleon, in terms of my mind, have most people thought of the French as being one of the most powerful armies. But really throughout most of the 19th century, they were top tier, right?
This is the twilight of that, the twilight of France as the preeminent military power. I think earlier, might have been a year ago on one of my episodes that kind of got sidetracked to talking about the Russo-Japanese War. Japan, when they're reopening about this time and they're looking for who are the best military trainers, they still bring in the French. The French, you still have Napoleon. And again, you haven't really had major... You know, this is the getting back to the last episode I did, this is that post-Vienna peace where you have fighting, you have the Crimean War, you have the wars of Italian unification, you have the wars of German unification, but you don't have general European conflagrations where an army could be found lacking. So right now, yeah, the French are still kind of the model that everyone uses.
Right. And again, the timing here is so setting the stage. I think we do need to do a very careful job of setting the stage here for a lot of our listeners, because it's very important to the historical what if, to understand the historical what did. So we find ourselves in 1862. We find ourselves in Mexico. And it's important to understand that while by the time we get to 1862, understanding why the French are here, we actually have to rewind the tape a little bit back to certainly back into at least the 1850s, if not before then, because a major thing has happened in Mexican history in the decade before, which is what sets up this whole course of events. By the way, it's a Monday for those of you that are playing at home. So if you didn't know that now, Cinco de Mayo, Cinco de Mayo, when it happened in 1862, happened on a Monday. So now you've got that to file away in your little mental file cabinet if you didn't know it already, and remembering that. So you may have to change your joke, Chris. You may have to change that to what it's like any other Monday, but Tuesday works as well.
At one point, I actually learned the German word for it, and that just kind of you could kind of guess that it's a German word, but yeah, like sometimes you have to explain that level of it.
And if you have to explain it, then either you're talking to the wrong audience or the joke's not quite what you need it to be. So help our listeners understand, Chris, why in 1862, the Mexican army is fighting a French invasion force.
The War of the Reform. So you and I were talking, you know, Mexican independence. Let's go ahead and get that out. Independence Day is September 16th. Celebrates the Grito de Dolores, the Cry of Dolores, beginning the resistance against the Spanish, getting the Spanish out. There, I made that mistake. And basically, they succeed in the 1820s, and from the 1820s up until the 1850s, the political situation in Mexico could be summed up as Santa Anna in France. He actually started out as a royalist Spanish general fighting against the insurgents in Mexico, but I think you mentioned he's kind of a share. He's just constantly making comebacks. He's constantly circling around. And for a while, he's a military general who's constantly changing sides and overthrowing the government. And kind of around, you know, 1830, he decides, I'm sick of using everybody. Why don't I just become the president? Why don't I just take over? And that's how Texas became a thing. That's how California became American. All of these goings on. And in the early 1850s, he's kind of formally defeated. He's gone. And you had this vacuum of the two sides fighting against each other in the War of the Reform. One side being a liberal side, and when I say liberal, they're looking for a decentralized government. They're looking for kind of a federation, states controlling, you know, the majority of the power, and universal suffrage, which is very important. You know, Indian communities can vote, peasants can vote. On the other side, you have a more conservative side, which wants the centralized military church, traditionally conservative side that wants everything on, you know, almost radiating from one center of power.
So help me get this. This is the image I have in my head. So I want to make sure I have the right image. So if I convey it, it is right. If I don't, I think of that side being much like, it's what Spain was before, only it's now just collapsed down to just being Mexico. It's the same structure that existed under Spanish ruled under Spanish occupation, carried forth now under a Mexican banner, versus the others that we want to be something different than what we fought this revolution for back in the early 19th century, and what we want to turn into. That's the liberal. It's not a modern liberal. It is a more liberal position, but it's not a modern liberal sits.
It's not just the political ideology inherited from the Spanish colonial powers. To a large extent, it's the people inherited from the Spanish colonial powers. You had a big sense of, and this is really important in other Latin American countries, peninsulares, who are people that are from the peninsula, from Spain, criollos, who are basically the descendants of peninsulares communities in these countries. And that is who largely is in charge of the church and the military, and who provide a lot of support to this conservative side, versus the liberals, who to some extent are more mestizo or more indigenous populations. In fact, the leader of the liberal side, Benito Juarez, was the first indigenous leader of Mexico. He was a leader that was not, could not trace his lineage back to Spain. So it's not just their ideology. To some extent, it's their family trees.
And so it's cultural, it's ideological, mm-hmm. it's political, it's religious, because mm-hmm. of the affiliation by the one side being much more connected with a combined church-state scenario versus something different. Mm-hmm. So this becomes civil war in the 1850s in Mexico. Yeah. Who wins?
The liberals.
Okay. And what happens during wars? Well, both sides tend to have to buy arms and they have to do things. Wars require money. That's true of wars between nations, and it's also true of civil wars. And so is it a fair thing to say that both sides of this reform war, they both run up a bill, right?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And not only that, but if you look at it, you're spending money on things that are getting blown up. You're spending money on bullets and on tanks. Modern day, you're spending it on tanks and these things. What you're not spending it on is improving your ports, building your railroads, expanding your mines. You're borrowing money to spend it on this military stuff. You're not spending it on stuff that's going to make it easier in the future to repay it.
Right. It's you're not borrowing on infrastructure. You're borrowing on expendables mm-hmm. and consumables that are the ultimate expendable and consumable, because they not only consume themselves, but they destroy other things that have infrastructure and value.
Right.
It is not building value. So who holds the debt here?
Who has money at this point, which is Europe. It is largely, it's Britain and France. Britain, and if you look at anyone who owes anybody any money in the 19th century, it's Britain and France. That's how Suez happened. That's how all of these other things throughout the world happened. In this case, you also have Spain in the mix because of the historical commercial connections there.
Right.
So those three
European powers are, and they're owed money by both sides. A good thing to do sometimes is to place your bets on both sides of the equation. And so you sort of mm-hmm. don't care who wins. Whoever wins is going to owe you something. And that's the way that I sort of interpret what happened here. Now that the war is over, they have this amazing concept. They want to get repaid.
The Europeans did.
Right.
Benito Juarez looks around at the country and realizes that it just can't. So what he does is he basically pronounces, you know what? We're not defaulting. We're not going to just walk away from the debt, because that's always something you have to worry about when you loan a government money. Either A, they're going to say, you know what? We don't remember borrowing that. Or they're just going to print up a whole bunch of bills and give you those. He doesn't do that. He doesn't walk away from the debt. He just says, we are not going to make the scheduled payments on it. We need to rebuild our country, and it's more important that we spend what we have on getting back on our feet than on shipping you money.
And so the expectation is, what I understood or believe that I understood from doing the research, was that these European powers expected not just the winning side to pay back their debt, but the winning side needs to pay back the losing side's debt as well. We're owed this money. You're victorious. You've assumed this responsibility. And so, as you just said, we're not going to default on this, but we're not ready to pay it yet. We need a deferment on this for at least 2 years. And that does not sit well with the European powers. And so what is their response to that?
Their response to that is very much their response to anyone else owing the money in the 19th century, which is to go and start breaking knees.
Which in this case means loading troops on ships and sailing those ships across the Atlantic and coming into the Gulf of Mexico and landing on the coast. And you're here to collect however it is you need to collect that.
Yes, they did land. It was a three-party landing. The British and the Spanish did also land. But what wound up happening is they looked around and said, you know what? You're right, Benito Juarez. This place is a dump. We agree with you. Go ahead and, you know, we'll get our money. Go ahead and get back on your feet. The other thing they kind of realized pretty quickly is that they have been hoodwinked by the French, because the French are using this as an excuse. You know, I mentioned earlier Egypt. The Suez Canal happened because the Khedive of Egypt owed European powers money, and he defaulted, they came in and took over. That's what the French are trying to do here. And the Spanish and English realize this and kind of say, you know what? You can do that. We're going home. We are not going to set up a colonial possession in Mexico. We trust the current government to pay us back. And we're going to withdraw our troops and support from this expedition.
Yep. And so the French are led by a guy whose name sounds familiar, but he's not the guy you might think that he is. He's Napoleon, but he's not the famous Napoleon Bonaparte that we know from the Napoleonic Wars. This is his nephew, Napoleon the Third.
Yes. I will be perfectly honest. I know who they say Napoleon the Second was, but it always makes me laugh that he's the Third. For some reason, they just skipped the second.
Well, you know, it happens.
Yeah.
It happens. So then the as we talked about, the pretense is the collection of the debt. Initially, it's three parties. It's the French, the British, and the Spanish. The Spanish and the British say, we're not going to be part of this. This is all part of a French mode. And what is the intent of Napoleon now, if he can't get paid and he's going to have to, you know, take over things and do things the other way? What does he intend to do?
This is a bust out. Whatever Mexican power he sets up is going to have a business partner. He's going to basically put in a puppet, a front man, and he's going to just, you know, open up a spigot and start draining the country dry.
Right. And so who is this magic guy that's going to be the face of Mexico under partnered with Napoleon III?
This is kind of the end of that era in European politics. There's one more thing that happens like this. He decides, you know what? I want to be friends with Austria. And so I'm going to invite an Austrian, you know, some minor noble, the Habsburg noble, to go over and take over Mexico. Because I'm giving them this, the Habsburgs in Austria will then be friendly to me, and this will lead to an alliance between Austria and France. So the noble he chooses is a guy named Maximilian.
which you couldn't have scripted that better, at least in my mind. You know, it's one of those great soon to be installed emperor kind of names. So I give them credit for, you know, not finding, you know, some Duke named Bob that was, you know, some distant Habsburg relative here. So they go to a good place to do this. So the intent is to install Maximilian as the emperor. He actually is installed as the emperor of Mexico for a period of time by the French. And how did they get him to come along and agree to this? To me, this is the other interesting part of the story. We'll sort of try to conclude up the what did here, get into the battle a bit so we can get out of the what if. Again, I just think this is one of those places it's really important to set the stage.
So what they did is they basically kind of sold him that the country of Mexico is asking you to come in. You are being invited to come take over this country. You have local supporters, and they were the losing side in the latest civil war. They're the conservatives. But now that we're back, they want you.
And he's even told that there's been like a referendum, a national election, which sort of says, is, you know, we want you, the people want you. The people are demanding you is the impression that I have from that. Is that a fair impression?
You know what? Actually, Napoleon III himself was one of the really big users of referendums. He would kind of put these things out, and you know, you picture some of the more modern illiberal democracies have these things where it's, oh, 95% of people voted for this. That must mean it's the good thing.
Right.
When like some of the ballots don't even have no printed on them. Right. Like that. Yeah.
Yeah. We've seen this type of election. Sadly, we've seen this type of election around the world. It gives the appearance of a democratic flair, but it really doesn't have that. So that sets us up to, again, a French army that is a very capable French army, certainly compared in terms of equipment, materiel. You have Mexican forces here that are experienced because they've just been through their own civil war. So it's not that you're lacking for folks who have fighting experience, but not the type of thing that you would expect the Mexicans to be successful in because they're outnumbered and essentially they're outgunned. Is that a fair summary?
It is. I would say they're experienced in the type of war they were fighting.
Right.
At the Battle of Puebla, one of the things the Mexican side makes a point of doing is they're defensive. It reminded me of kind of a Bunker Hill situation. I didn't want to mention it because that is independence and it's not this.
Right.
But they are entrenched in these fortifications. And what they've been doing is fighting each other in kind of small action guerrilla warfare. They take these positions, the French keep attacking, just like, you know, Bunker Hill situation did. And when they finally lose, the Mexican cavalry charges and wipes them out, but they don't follow up specifically because they realize we don't fight European field battles like this. If you look at a map of the Americans, of a battle of the American Civil War, you see these nice rectangles. This person is marching there and this person is marching there. That's not how they fought.
Right.
And they knew it. So they intentionally didn't fight like that.
So to sort of shortcut through the historical what did here, which again, I know we've gone a little bit long on that, so we apologetic for that for the last time, but setting up the historical what did is we eventually reach a place where French forces have pushed inland now from the coast to the city of Puebla, which is in sort of, I don't know how to describe this, it's south of where Mexico City is today, bending around towards the Yucatan, but now inland from Veracruz there, where they've actually come in and they've established a base of operations and they're pushing westward. So they come to this town, fortified, the troops are there. So this is in, again, this is in early, this is in 1862, in the April-ish into May period of time here. And the most interesting thing happens. The Mexican army is able to earn a victory there in this Battle of Puebla. Now, it's important to say that a year later, there will be another the siege of Puebla, which will go in the other direction. The French will eventually take this city. They will just take it in 1863 and not in 1862. And that becomes really, really, really important when we get over into the what if, because ultimately the Cinco de Mayo commemorates the Mexican victory in May of 1862. At the same place, there is a later event that is not a Mexican victory. Ultimately, Puebla is in the hands of the French a little over a year later.
Yes, it's basically on the road to Mexico City from Veracruz. So they do take it. They take Mexico City. And in 1863, late 63 into 64, basically Maximilian takes over most of Mexico. I mentioned Benito Juarez. He's the president of, he's the guy being pushed out by the French. I almost said legitimate. He's a legitimate president. Okay. I'm not even going to play that he wasn't. He's a legitimate president. He is up in Chihuahua, which is kind of, it's interesting that if you look at the United States Mexico border, you have sister cities. So Brownsville is right on the coast, and its sister is Matamoros. The city opposite El Paso is named Ciudad Juarez.
Right.
After this, because that's where he set up his camp after kind of being pushed into the northern wilds of Mexico. So to push all the way through. In a lot of our histories, getting back to the last episode I did, if you are sitting in Europe in 1920, there's no avoiding World War II. You're in a railroad tunnel and you see a light coming and you just can't do much about it. And that imagery has reminded me of a lot, because in this instance, Maximilian is sitting in the middle of a tunnel. And he's got two massive trains coming at him. One is the American Civil War. By this point, by 63, 64, it's largely decided one way. And he is scrambling to get himself established before the United States takes back over Texas.
Right.
Because he realizes, hey, United States doesn't like me. There's such a thing as the Monroe Doctrine, where the United States has said they do not allow European powers to take over American republics, which is what I just did. So I need to get established before the Americans come back into Texas and win that civil war. And now, by the way, have all of these guns sitting around and all of these people who know how to use them, and they don't need them. So Juarez can use them.
Right.
On the other end, I mentioned in passing that Napoleon III used this as an opportunity to forge an alliance with Austria way back in Europe. Well, in 1866, Austria gets caught up in a war with Prussia. And this was one of Bismarck's things. He's trying to basically push Austria out of the German Confederation. And Napoleon is looking at this and saying, you know what? I kind of like the German Confederation. I like all these small little states protecting me from Prussia. I kind of don't want Austria to get wiped out here. The only problem with that is he has fully 16%, almost one in five of every one of his troops. And these are the best troops he's got. He's not putting the B team over there, are over in Mexico. So around 1865, 66, two things just pull the legs out from under Maximilian. One of them being the United States winning the Civil War. It now sends a flood of support and people and troops over to help. Not officially troops, but, you know, people, okay, you retire and, hey, look, sign up with this. Send them south. And all of his French supporters, all of his French troops are withdrawn back to France because Napoleon III realizes Prussia's now on the run.
Right.
I now share a border with them, and I probably need them more here than I do over in there.
Right. So the end result is French give up their efforts in Mexico. Maximilian is gone. And in fact, he's eventually executed. what he gets for coming in and answering what he thought was answering the call of the populace is he gets executed. And we have the flow of history as we know it. That's the historical what did. So we're going to take our fork here at the Battle of Puebla, that spunky little group of Mexican soldiers aren't successful there. And so that city falls, and it falls in 1862 and not in 1863. And we've already hit upon this. The backdrop, what has prevented the United States from becoming and just intervening in the intervention? In fact, this is typically referred to as the second French intervention in Mexico. That's how it's described. Mm-hmm. The first one's sort of funny because it has this neat little thing called the Pastry War attached to it. If you want to go chase some historical fun there, that's an interesting thing to go and do. But the reason the U.S. doesn't intervene in response to the French, British and Spanish, but ultimately the French intervention, is again, they're occupied with the American Civil War. They're distracted away from being the enforcers of the Monroe Doctrine because they're having a war inside their own country. So once that's gone, as you've just talked about, things go back in the other direction. But in 1862, the war is not in the same place as it will be just a year later in 1863. And that's where the fork gets interesting, right, Chris?
Right. That 1 year between the two battles, we'll call them the two battles of Puebla. I do feel like the second one is called the Siege of Puebla. Siege,
right.
Just to prevent the confusion.
Right. Yeah, it's a little bit like, well, you know, I'm thinking about it even now, the American Civil War, because, you know, the two sides use different ways. One used towns and one used creeks or tributaries. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, first and second Manassas or first and second Bull Run, for example, depending on which side you're on, you know, distinguishing which one. One is called the Battle of Puebla, which the Mexicans won. One is called the Siege of Puebla, which they lost. By the way, not to be confused with one like 6 years previous to both of those, where Puebla's it's strategically located. There's a reason why, you know, things keep happening here because of the topography. So in this scenario, Mexico loses in 1862, which you presume that allows the French then to move further across the country, consolidate their position, put Maximilian now in a stronger position overall. Mm-hmm. It's still in a time when the Americans are not now going to be able to intervene again. They're still tied up here. But suddenly, if you have a French success in 1862, the most important fork, I think, or the most important ripple that we see here, there are others, is it's not just what happens inside of Mexico. That's important. But now this thing ripples out to changing the landscape of the American Civil War, likely, right?
Very easily. In just to kind of take a step back and get into some of what, you know, in my initial, when we talked about the idea of the timeline for this, there's a couple of different things that are happening like right at the same time as these important events in the, let's call it the what did arc we just got done talking about. For example, the British, Spanish, and French getting together and deciding to send troops to Mexico happens in November 1861. I am not a sailor. I do not know shipping routes. But that is exactly the same time as the Trent Affair is happening, which is basically a British ship steaming from Canada to Great Britain carrying Confederate representatives trying to negotiate intervention. The United States stops it and basically arrest these two people. And it's a huge problem for Abraham Lincoln because that's kind of how the War of 1812 happened. You don't stop foreign ships and take people off it.
Right.
And so I have this image of those two very important ships crossing paths because it happens at exactly the same time. If you look at what happened in, you know, okay, the Battle of of Puebla on May 5th, 1862. If you look at what's going on, that is the same day as the Battle of Williamsburg in the Peninsula Campaign, which is McClellan trying to come around and come up into Richmond. By the way, that's where Lee takes over. Lee is not in charge of the Army of Northern Virginia yet. So there's a lot of stuff happening. Everything that he does hasn't happened yet.
Right.
All of his victories haven't happened yet. The other thing is, 10 days after the Battle of Puebla, Benjamin Butler occupies New Orleans, which was the major tobacco port, the major cotton port, which is what the South was counting on. Their whole, many of them realized in a straight up, you know, stand in front of the other guy and fight, we're not able to do this. So our hope is if we can export cotton, we can use the European dependence on cotton. Manchester and Northern France, where the first industrial revolutions happened, the first thing they started doing was making fabric, and they were dependent upon that cotton from the Southern United States. There was large economic displacement in these industrial areas when that raw material got stopped. So the Confederacy is counting on encouraging European intervention by trade. They also are able to get hard currency, or just basically to trade cotton for guns or other things they need to carry out the war. With the fall of New Orleans in our timeline, that stops. The United States Navy is able to blockade the South and to a large extent stop them from dealing with Europe.
Right.
That's no longer the case in our fork. Because in our fork, the French have a very, 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 very friendly government in Mexico. They are able to trade overland with the cotton to get those supplies. The interesting thing I mentioned off podcast, even with the 1 year shift, and it's a critical year, once Maximilian does take over, something like 2/3 the population of Matamoros, the city I mentioned that is kind of the analog on the Mexican side of the Rio Grande, from Brownsville, which for those of you, I guess, that aren't familiar with Texas geography,
that's on the Gulf. That's a port city, or that's directly there to where you're now talking about shipping interest. That's not the same as, right, as was talked about with the other, you know, parallel cities that expand across the border. Today that's a modern McAllen, modern Brownsville. Mm-hmm. Right across the border is Matamoros.
Yep, it's the southern terminus of Texas. Even with the 1 year shift, something like 2/3 of the population of Matamoros were foreign nationals there buying up cotton to ship back to Europe. And this is in 64, after the South has lost the Mississippi.
Right.
So the only cotton they have access to is Texas, Arkansas, and some stuff you can smuggle across the Mississippi. But if we're having this discussion before 63 in the loss of Vicksburg, it's a lot easier. And there's a lot more of it to ship out.
And as we were talking off podcast as well, the question then suddenly exists, the extent to which the United States, meaning here the Union, is mm-hmm. willing to actually do anything that intervenes in foreign trade because of the danger that presents of getting pulled into conflicts with European powers. One thing to be involved in a civil war with states that have seceded from the Union that you're trying to restore, but it's another thing to get involved with the powers in Europe and be cross with them. And because again, both sides need some of the things that they can get from those, that, you know, it benefits everybody to not have that go that way. As you already hit upon it, you know, the interesting thing in 63, the siege of Puebla starts in March and finishes up in May. you know, 63 is the critical turning point year, obviously, in the American Civil War, particularly late June, early July in 1963. In fact, you know, these events are happening almost simultaneously. You mentioned Vicksburg. Vicksburg is so crucial because it's the controlling interest in the on the Mississippi. Once Vicksburg is lost, the Union has complete control of the Mississippi, which is a powerful thing to have control of for transport, for commerce, for moving military material, everything that goes with that. Then also at the same time as the Battle of Gettysburg in early July. Those things happen basically on the same, essentially on the same day almost.
No, they happen on the same day.
Right.
July 4th.
That's exactly right. And so much so, you know, if you're familiar with Ken Burns' Civil War series, they talk about the fact that, you know, July 4th was not celebrated again in Vicksburg for like, you know, the better part of a century or something like that because of the changing what the commemoration of the date was. Gettysburg is July 1, 2, and 3. So it's over by July 4. That's in 1863. That's actually when the Siege of Puebla, the successful French action, takes place is in 63. You go back, as you said, a year before, and you change the landscape. You change the commerce, as you described there. The status maybe of Vicksburg gets changed because of what's happening there. You know, in my mind, you know, this is where I want to get your opinion. There's two possible ways that you can see the war going, the war here being the American. We started out talking about the French intervention, but now we're talking about the real fork is about the American Civil War because of the relationship that exists with Mexico. French supported Mexico becomes an ally of the Confederacy, directly so, which changes that a little bit, maybe even, you know, provides material. Who knows? You know, ultimately could have happened. But in my mind, the American Civil War then goes one of two ways. It gets much longer, much bloodier. It's much more protracted because there's a leveling out of the economics of the war. Part of the reason the Union wins, they have more men. They have more mechanism with industrial might to be able to do things. Mm-hmm. The South is an agrarian economy, cotton being the thing that produces revenue. So that's one of the balances there. Or there's the realization that this thing's going to go on for a long period of time. So now we need to find some settlement that is a suit for peace. And so you end up with two separate American states, the Confederate States of America and the United States of America now existing and the Confederate States would have been more than happy to have had that be the circumstance. So in my mind, there's very little middle ground to me. If you can come up with one, I'd love to hear it. But it's either this thing's going to be bloodier and much longer under the scenario that could happen as a result of a change, what happens at the Battle of Puebla, or the other extreme is it doesn't end in a Union victory. It ends in, at least for some period of time, in a stalemate. Maybe we have whatever the equivalent would be, whatever parallel that would be in the United States, essentially, you know, running across there. The Mason-Dixon line becomes our equivalent of the parallel between the North and South America, if you will. It's not what they're going to be called, the Union and the Confederate States of America. But you actually get into that situation where that could go on for not just years, that could go on for decades or could still be going on today.
Well, you're talking about one train, but there's another train. I think what's happening in Europe, the problem is there's so much happening right now. There are so many things going on. In off podcast, I think we were talking about, Lincoln, and I do believe that Lincoln would not have accepted any agreement. And I said, oh, Lincoln's good through 68. He's not. The election of 1864 hasn't happened yet. And I think that's a really good, you know, if I'm looking realistically, I think that's a possibility that you have a McClellan winning as a peace candidate. Just to throw this out there, to get back to something, let's assume that happens and there is a divided United States. The remaining United States still has a border in the Arizona, in the California area. And I don't think any American government is going to be okay with Maximilian still existing. So I'm of the opinion. So I think this could come back full circle. And after, if there is a peace in 66, 67, nothing is going to change in the European situation. Maximilian's French support is going to be withdrawn. And the United States may still be supporting Juarez's forces. And he may come, they may still be able to do that. At the same time, I'm realizing that the Confederate government is not going to sit kindly and let that happen. So they'll probably, so it could be kind of this North American proxy civil war going on for a long time.
Yeah, you know, the thing that popped into my head there, and I don't know if it's the right analogy, and this is chasing away from what we had talked about before, but you know, I'm thinking about, you know, here in the United States, we refer to the French and Indian War. That was a precursor to the American Revolution. You know, that's what we call it in the United States. It actually has a different name that it's known by in Europe, known as the Seven Years' War. It's called the French and Indian War because that was the name given to it by primarily British settlers here in the United States, because the enemy were the French and their Native American allies. It's called the Seven Years' War in Europe. And I kept thinking about this idea of this thing has the potential to flare up in North America for the reasons you just described there, but then it also has connections back over to how that potentially plays out in Europe. And so maybe it's quiet in North America till something flares up in Europe and it spreads here, or maybe it's the other way happens on occasion, and maybe this happens multiple times. Mm-hmm. There's a flare up here, which then suddenly pulls something now that goes on in Europe. And the long period of time you talked about in the 19th century, basically the period of time from, after Napoleon is defeated, all the way, we talked about this in a couple of episodes ago, all the way up until World War One, there's this long period. Relatively speaking, there's no such thing as peace in Europe ever fully, but there's not the full blown continent wide conflicts that happened during that whole period of time. Maybe there's not that because there are things now that are happening in North America because the interests that are at play that cause those to flare back up, or the other way around. So as you said, there's multiple trains here, and the two things can play off each other.
Right. Right. I actually find this, now that we're talking about this and I'm thinking about it, you and I haven't explicitly talked about it, but I think Harry Turtledove and his books are something we've both really been interested in. And the situation we're describing sounds very similar to what he comes up with, where you do have a pro-Southern Mexican Empire.
Right.
Controlled by the French.
Yeah. And so again, that play now it's not the case of, you know, we talked about the reason in the real timeline, in the historical, what did eventually, once the American Civil War is over, now America comes back and says, we had this guy, president, his name was Monroe. We have this thing called the Monroe Doctrine. We're serious about this, about European affairs, and so now that there's a United States post Civil War to be able to go and enforce that, that's one thing. The U.S. that existed while there would still be a Confederate States of America is a very different entity in terms of trying to carry that out for very different reasons, and may find that Confederate States of America an ally against somebody that they're trying to take that action again. In my opinion, one of the things, you know, I hadn't thought about it exactly this way, but one of the deaths that happens if you change the Battle of Puebla is you may actually have the death of the Monroe Doctrine as we know and think about it today. It may resurface again at some point down the road, but it's not going to be an active thing that happens like it was for a long period of time.
As a nice little, interesting little thing that went through my head, let's say that it does play out and the United States does try and support Juarez through, okay, we do make a peace, we are trying to support Juarez, we're not going to call it the Monroe Doctrine anymore. Because where's Monroe from? Not the United States anymore.
He's from Virginia. So, I hadn't even thought about that. Wow. And again, short-lived, because Monroe, he issues the doctrine in Is it 1823 is the date that's in my head all of a sudden now? We're not that far removed from that. This was a new concept. I mean, you know, this was not, you know, well-established, you know, a century-long policy of the United States that had been backed by other action. This is a generation ago.
Well, that's largely, you know, to kind of get back to what we were talking about, actual Mexican independence happens in 1821. So it's the independence of Mexico and of the countries, especially along the northern coast of South America. Spain didn't recognize Mexico's independence until, I believe, they lost Texas. After they lost Texas, Spain was not okay with this.
Right.
And that Monroe Doctrine came out because now there are other American republics, and they were very small and weak, and this was a real attempt to protect them. I'm interested in thinking about what we talked about, the Pastry War. That was a foreign military intervention to get the money back, but it wasn't to change the political right. structure, and that's kind of the line that Monroe set.
So we quickly took this from being about Mexico and took it to the United States. Very American of us to have done that in the
past.
So let's circle back and talk about how things would be different in Mexico.
I just want to say, leave it to a Texan to just throw some rice and beans into it and make it their own thing.
Yeah, that's what we do.
Yeah. Back, what happens in Mexico? I think an interesting, just to get with another topic, think about what's going on in Brazil right about now. You have a Brazilian empire who was, Pedro I, largely a Portuguese royal who stayed in power up until the 1880s. So I think that's a possibility. The one thing, and we short-circuited on it a little bit. The problem with what Maximilian did in Mexico was he came over and he tried to be a European, enlightened, progressive, liberal monarch like Napoleon was. That's not what his natural supporters wanted. He comes over as an enlightened, progressive leader. The people that want enlightened progress, expanded votes, all these things, already have a leader who you just kicked out. So you're not going to win them. But you do have this kind of more European-focused, conservative church military group that you definitely could build on. And looking at what actually wound up happening in our timeline, getting in the weeds here. One of the commanders at Puebla was a man named Porfirio Diaz. He supports Juarez. Later on, he overthrows Juarez. And he is the military leader of Mexico straight up until 1911. So I think you could have, that period is known as Porfiriato. You could have had the Maximilian, I promise I can do this, the Maximilianato, where he just stays in power because, Diaz was very important with the United States because he traded. He had a good relationship. So I think once the Civil War is over, if you've got a centralizer, a conservative leader who's willing to trade and deal with the United States, I think you could have a really positive relationship and they'd be okay with him.
Yeah.
So maybe he could survive if he just realizes who in Mexico actually wants him.
Right. And so then, you know, you carry that down, if you really ripple that down a long way down to today. Culturally, Mexico is going to be similar to what we think of it being today. But politically, you know, that's a different way that it would have evolved, a different way that it would have happened. And certainly you would have continued to have much more French involvement. So where, for example, is, well, you know, where the French were during World War One, assuming there still is a World War One and all of that happens. But you even talked about, you know, what impact does this maybe have back on, you know, some of the unification efforts that happen. And this has ripples that go all the way across. Mm-hmm. The other thing that just crossed my mind, because it's been fresh, did the episode here 20 episodes back or so about the Panama Canal. We've talked about the Suez Canal. The backdrop of what's going on sort of also while this happening is this is while the Suez Canal is being built and is being mm-hmm. done. Eventually the French, how they end up in Panama is, De Jessup's, you know, is done with the one project and now they're going to go and do that. One of the, there still is a discussion about doing this. I forget exactly where it is. So I'm not going to butcher it and go look it up now because I wasn't planning to go here, but there is an area across Mexico that would be a potential place you might try to make a canal that would not be the traditional places that were thought of, which is crossing Panama because it's narrowest there with all kinds of challenges. Strongly recommend The Path Between the Seas by David McCullough. I just finished that recently. It does an excellent job of describing that. But then there was also the Nicaragua concept for the canal. These were competing things that both the French and the Americans looked at. Imagine now, though, that you don't have the Panama Canal. You don't have the Nicaraguan Canal, but the French very logically finish up the Suez Canal, and they come to build what? The Mexican Canal. And if that happens in the late 19th century, that changes a lot.
Yeah, that does. The one thing I'd say, I feel like the United if there is still a United States, if the United States is still our country that we know of today, I feel like the Panama Canal happens as a national security counterpoint to the French Mexico Canal. We're not going to be okay with a foreign country. We're okay with Panama controlling the Panama Canal, but not a European big player controlling how we can get back and forth. Right. Interesting point. I don't know if you've come across this. The McLean-Ocampos Treaty was signed between the United States and Mexico in 1859. And what it would have done is the United States would have bought the rights to move, to basically set up a free trade area and eventually do a canal and transit everything we wanted over this route that you just mentioned, straight south, kind of almost due south from Veracruz over to the Pacific coast.
It's the Isthmus of Tehuantepec is what it is. I had to go and look it up because I just had to know. And there's been a lot of discussion. There still is modern discussion there about, you know, what happened with Panama and what, you know, was that a railroad was built first to transport from one port to the other. And then it was, okay, now the ships can go directly. The same concept there. There's been these concepts of actually being able to load up ships on this thing that would transport them across the land there. And that still exists. But I agree with you. The idea of it, I think there very much could have been because of the French involvement in Mexican politics and their involvement in the Suez Project. You could very easily see the French coming over to assist in building that Mexican canal. But then the next thing that would happen, but again, like you said, whatever is left in terms of an American government or, you know, maybe even a confederate would not sit kindly to having that be the control to get from one place to the other.
But so here's the last thing about that treaty I was just talking about, 1859, 1860, it would have bought the rights for the United States to use this. The United States Senate killed that bill because they weren't sure how that would affect what everybody saw was coming with the Civil War. But take a step back. If the United States buys those transit rights from the Mexican government, The Mexican government now has the money to pay the European powers, and this never even happens.
Right. Yeah. So multiple ways you can make this insignificant is they have a funding mechanism to pay back the debt.
But the one thing I'd say about this idea of a French canal is, yes, they're working in Suez now, and Suez is relatively easy to do. If you look at it from an engineering standpoint, it's a, and I say that as like it just got blocked a couple of weeks ago. Yes, I know. It's a ditch.
Right.
It has nowhere near the engineering that it takes to do Panama. However, I don't see anything changing Europe and the rise of Prussia and the rise of Germany. France is going to get beaten in 5 years. They're going to lose Franco-Prussian. So that's going to kind of put them back on their heels. And that's, you know, I said earlier, oh, it's Tuesday in Germany. That's when the jokes about the French stuff. That's when France is no longer the preeminent land power. And I think those concerns are going to cause the French to kind of pull back from their colonial adventures. If you look at the French Empire, Algeria is the 1830s. You know, Southeast Asia, they have, let's assume, but after 1870, they aren't really one of those powers looking to gobble stuff up. Right. They're a little more focused at home, and I don't think what we've talked about would have changed that. So I think kind of thinking about Napoleon I's Louisiana after he lost Haiti. We have it. It's out there, but it's not as important as it could be.
Right. So what did we miss, Chris?
I don't think we missed a whole lot. I don't know that there is anything we missed. I mean, I think we've had a really solid episode. We've talked about the holiday invented by Big Lime. the Citrus Lobby, that's right. Yeah.
If Hallmark created Mother's Day, then as you said, we've died off podcast. Corona probably created Cinco de Mayo, right?
And then hired a new PR team that just, they need to get on top of that. They've just, you know, seriously, you created your own holiday and now you shut down the world. You need to get a better PR team. That's all I'm saying.
I would agree. Once again, Chris, it's always good. And I love the fact that when we do an episode together, you and I do spend some time talking before. And then somewhere in the middle of it, we end up finding that the rabbit crosses the trail that we've got to go and chase. So in my case, it's suddenly realizing, oh my goodness, you move where the canal is. And the irony of that, I was just thinking about to the map of where Puebla is. Yeah, it's not directly near the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, but it's really not that far away. That's also how that sort of comes, but you know, back full circle. It's there in central Mexico and where that's at. And I've been particularly fascinated for the last couple of months since I read The Path Between the Seas. I do recommend that, by the way, Dave McCullough. Audible is one of our affiliates for the pro. If you want to take a listen to that, you know, click in the show notes. You can see there how to get your free month of Audible. I would recommend you do that as a free read. If somebody chooses to do that, taking advantage of what we offer here on a Fork in Time for you to get your 1 month free and your free book from Audible. Path Between the Seas, I did it as an audio listen, is a good audio listen. It's a good translator, and they do a good job of describing that. You get a tremendous understanding of, as you point out, the engineering feat that the Panama Canal was, that the Nicaragua Canal would have also been a challenge for. And the Mexican Canal, the Tehuantepec Canal, would have had different challenges, but it was not an easy thing to build any of these canals that shortcut the need to go around South America, very different than the Suez situation. Like you said, basically a glorified, we saw how valuable that glorified ditch was here recently, and just where things stood, but how valuable, you know, that was a glorified ditch. Not to say it was not an important accomplishment, not to say that it hasn't been important in the history, but nothing like what was acquired for any of those other three canals that would have been in the Americas. So again, Chris, good to have you with us. We're going to let our listeners know that if you want to find out more about the podcast, recommend that you visit our website. That's www.aforkintimepodcast.com. We still have the episode 101-102 survey up on the website. If you go there, those little four questions of feedback, the one I care most about was, do you like or don't like the robot voice at the beginning of the podcast? Folks have weighed in on that. I'm not going to tell you what the results are, Chris. Early voting is trending there, but I'm not going to tell you what it is, so it's not too late to cast your ballots and get in there, but love the feedback there. The other thing I just want to mention again is we are working towards the new podcast that we're launching here from A Fork in Time. That's The Room Where It Happened. And so if you want to find out more about that, actually, if you go to the website now, there's a link there that'll take you to the little introductory piece that we have for that, which I strongly recommend, and some other things that are happening there as well. But again, most importantly, we thank you for giving us some of your time and supporting the podcast, and appreciative of Chris joining the team and being part of this episode today. And we're going to invite you back next time, where if we happen upon a fork in time, we're probably just going to, you know, what we're going to do, Chris, is what we do. We're probably just going to
take it.
Take it. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast. Learn more and provide feedback by visiting our website at www.aforkintimepodcast.com. Connect to us on Facebook at facebook.com/aforkintime or follow us on Twitter at AFIT Podcast. If you want to support the show financially, visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/aforkintime. We hope you will join us next time.